This is Unit 11, Ruling in the Fear of God. Let's look at the introduction. Our study in the fear of God gets painfully personal in these next two chapters. Nothing tests our real understanding of and experience in the fear of the Lord more than how we carry out our responsibilities as authorities and how we respond to authorities. Anyone can talk like a Christian and maintain a plastic veneer of Christianity, but his real Christian experience is exposed by how he relates to authority, both as a ruler himself and as a subordinate. There is probably no problem that plagues home, church, business, and civil leadership more than the wrong use of authority. Leaders often do not rule in the fear of God. Consequently, those under their care are discouraged, disenchanted, and often rebellious to their authority. There is a biblical prescription for the predicament, no matter how it manifests itself. It is for leaders to rule in the fear of God. Pay careful attention to this session because all of us are put in positions of sovereignty or rulership at times, and it will expose how much you fear the Lord. I want to read you some extended vignettes from Created for His Glory, and the first one is Teresa's story, just to kind of set the stage for what we're going to be talking about here tonight. And these scenes are not uncommon. A woman in her early 40s sobs out her story as she seeks help from a godly woman in her church. Her husband, Joel, has not shown any real spiritual depth for their entire 20 years of marriage. He is actively involved in service opportunities at their church, but at home he is spiritually colorless. He will lecture their teens, two sons and a daughter, about being irresponsible or rebellious, but doesn't make any attempt to seriously disciple them. He rules them by the force of his quick-tempered personality and his power to ground them or assign them work details. His way of handling people and problems is by controlling them with more force. Teresa has begged Joel, and by the way, these vignettes don't represent anybody that you or I know. They're just combinations of a lot of situations I've dealt with. Teresa has begged Joel to be more gentle with the children. She has watched the light go out in their eyes. They have given up trying to please their father out of any sense of devotion. They do so now simply to escape his wrath and restrictions. Teresa's heart breaks as she sees them hardening their wills against their dad and against God. To make matters worse, the boys are having trouble at school. In junior high, they both acted up quite a bit, but now in high school, the stakes are higher. Both of them have been suspended once for continued disrespect to teachers and even to the principal himself. The next time could mean expulsion. In addition, she has watched her daughter become very sensual. Joel thought her tight skirts and blouses were cute in junior high and even commented to his daughter about how grown up she looked as her body filled out. Her dress now in high school is no longer cute. It is downright seductive. And the boys at school and in the youth group have noticed. Teresa is worried about where this will lead, but Joel dismisses her concerns as prudish. Teresa also confides that the marriage itself is on shaky ground. She has even threatened to leave Joel. His simple reply is, "Where would you go and how do you intend to finance your expedition?" The light has gone out in her eyes as well. She has lost all hope that he will ever change. She has pleaded with him to go with her to the pastor for counseling. Joel insists there is nothing wrong with his life and tells her that if she would be more submissive to him, the children wouldn't be having so many problems either. He has forbidden her to see the pastor. She has dutifully complied with that specific request, but now out of desperation is talking with a woman in the church she deeply respects for her godliness. This is Robin's story. Robin's husband, Phil, is very much the opposite of Joel. While Joel is quick-tempered and controlling when handling problems, Phil is quiet-tempered and complacent. Robin and Phil have been married 10 years and have two elementary-aged children. Samuel, the oldest, is 7 and is autistic. Kendra is 5. They determined that because Samuel required so much care that they could not have any more children after Kendra was born. And until recently, Kendra has been an easy child to raise. She has been cheerful, helpful, and obedient to her mother, who must spend much of her day attending to Samuel's needs. Robin has tried to deal with her growing bitterness to Phil, who doesn't help with Samuel when he is home. He fancies himself to be an internet day trader in his time at home and spends many hours every evening at his computer playing the stock market. He plays with Kendra when she pesters him enough, but he is totally uninvolved with Samuel. Robin has asked Phil if he resents Samuel, or if he is afraid to interact with him because of his special needs, but Phil denies there is any problem. He merely comments that Samuel responds best to her and leaves it at that. Phil and Robin haven't had a serious spiritual discussion since their first year of marriage. He says he reads his Bible while on his break at work, but Robin has never seen him open his Bible at home. 1 year ago, she was ordering some clothes online and found pornographic URLs in the browser history of their computer. She confronted Phil about it, but he laughed it off and said he was playing a joke on someone at work. He never could explain how his viewing pornography could be used as a joke, but he insisted she didn't have to worry about him. Nonetheless, she checked the browser history in the days ahead and found he had accessed many additional links. Talking with Phil about it again was useless. He tried to make her think that because he had gone to some sites the first time, he had been put on some kind of mailing list that automatically put those links in the browser history. Again, she didn't know enough about computers to prove him wrong, but she learned later that his explanation was a lie and it was impossible. Robin began to have some physical problems of her own. A spastic colon now makes her life miserable, and her spirits are heading deeper and deeper into despair. Samuel still needs constant attention. Kendra senses the tension in the home and her mother's despair and is growing increasingly irritable herself. Phil is the only one who hasn't changed. He is still resolutely distant from the family. And let's consider both Phil and Joel. Our hearts go out to Teresa and Robin. We sympathize with the crushing burdens these women bear because their husbands have misused headship, as in the case of Joel, or abandoned headship, as in the case of Phil. Though Joel and Phil are the main causes of their family's hopelessness, if they were to ever be honest with themselves, they would have to admit that they have been losing hope too. Joel sees his ill-temperedness and has tried various tactics to help himself get it under control. The bare facts staring him in the face show him that he is losing his family and he doesn't know what to do. His pride is still too strong for him to humble himself before his wife and children to ask their forgiveness. He reasons that even if he did, he would turn around and mess up again. He still refuses to see the pastor. He has seen some chinks in the pastor's armor when he worked on a special projects committee at the church and doesn't feel that he should have to spill his guts to someone who doesn't have his act together either. So Joel continues in his frustration while his anger and heavy-handedness tears his family apart. Phil, too, in his more sober moments, knows that his growing pornography addiction is going to catch up with him in some way. He knows Robin is taxed to her limit caring for Samuel, but it is easier simply to lose his troubled thoughts in his stock trading and pornography than to deal with the problems at home. He solaces himself with the thought that he is providing for his family financially through his trading efforts. Deep down, he knows he is failing, but won't allow himself to think about it much. He avoids such uncomfortable thoughts, just like he avoids uncomfortable responsibilities. Now, God does have a solution for leaders like Phil and Joel, and it is a solution that will bring hope to their own souls, and it will also breathe fresh air into the souls of their wives as well. God does have a prescription for failing leaders. In 2 Samuel 23, 1-5, there is a passage we call the last words of David. David is on his deathbed and has anointed Solomon king and is giving a charge to his son. And these are a portion of his words. He says, David says, "He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God." David knew that to be just, to fulfill the responsibilities in the proper fashion, a man had to be ruling in the fear of God. And neither Phil or Joel are just. They're not fulfilling their responsibilities as they ought. And they are not ruling in the fear of God. In fact, they are placing themselves first instead of God and other people. And before we even get into these applications for rulers, I think it's important for us to understand that these truths we're going to talk about are not just for fathers. All of us are placed in positions of leadership, or as I use the word throughout this discussion, sovereignty, rulership over other people, headship. All of us have those positions once in a while, or at times. A mother can be in a position of responsibility over the children. She is in a position of responsibility over the children. But a fleshly mother can be just as much a tyrant at home as any man. A fleshly mother can be just as negligent in her responsibilities as a fleshly man. And it's the same for students in leadership positions. If they are ruling in the flesh, they can be negligent or heavy-handed as well. It is the same for men in the workplace. They can be abusive and tyrannical and harsh and condescending and critical and impatient at work as well when they're walking in the flesh. And it's important for us to understand, all of us to understand, this role as it particularly applies to men for several reasons. Because if you are a man, it's very important for you and me to get a hold of this. If you are a wife of a man, which is the only kind of wife you can be, should be, if you're a wife, then this will tell you how to pray for the man God has put in your life. If you are raising sons, this will tell you what you need to be working on in his life so that he can be a man ruling in the fear of God. If you're raising daughters, you can be teaching them what kind of God-fearing men they ought to be dating and looking at. If you are a single man looking for a wife, this will tell you what kinds of things ought to be in your life as you look to be a leader. If you are a single woman looking for a leader, this tells you what. So this applies to all of us. We have to know what God-fearing men look like and how they operate. Well, we need to review. Let me go on with David's comment here. After he said, "He that ruleth over men shall be just, ruling in the fear of God," he went on to say, "And he shall be as the light of the morning when the sun riseth, even a morning without clouds, as a tender grass springing out of the earth by clear sunshine after rain." You know what he's saying? A man that rules in the fear of God will be welcomed like a cloudless morning. Ever awakened and been outside early in the morning when it's sun is just coming up and maybe there's still dew on the grass and it's everything is just fresh and invigorating? And that's the picture David is portraying here and saying, when you have this kind of a God-fearing leader, when he shows up, everybody is just energized and invigorated because he's ruling in the fear of God. They're not running for cover because dad's coming home. They're not making little comments under their breath about dad when he shows up. A God-fearing man is welcomed like a cloudless morning by his followers. There's a diagram in your notes that appears like this. I call this the grand reality. We've talked a little bit about this in the first few chapters. This is the most significant statement of reality there is, that God is a creator and that we are creatures and we are under him. That's what putting man under that bar means. We are under God. And if you ever get this mixed up in any way, everything is off base. This is the grand reality, that God exists and he made us. And that has enormous implications for us. He is first of all and he is over all. And everything is a distortion in our lives if that is ever forgotten or ignored. Let me bring some scriptures to bear on that. Isaiah 46, 9 to 10 says, "Remember the former things of old. For I am God, and there is none else." That's that exclusiveness we talked about in his supremacy. He's first above all. "I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." Psalm 115:3, "But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased." You heard of that bumper sticker, "There is a God in heaven and you ain't him." And God is saying here, I am the one overall and I do whatever I please. Now again, that would be a scary thing if God weren't a gracious, kind God. But when God is saying he does everything he pleases, he does all his pleasure, that's for our good as well, that he does what pleases him. Psalm 33, 6 to 8 says, "By the word of the Lord were the heavens made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth." This is a grand reality. "He gathereth the waters of the sea together as an heap. He layeth up the depth in storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him." Job 42, 1 to 3, "Then Job answered the Lord and said," after God had displayed himself, all of his attributes of wisdom and power before Job, this is Job's response, "I know that thou canst do anything." That's a modern rendition of this would be our elephant joke. When an elephant comes to your house, where does he sit down? The answer is anywhere he wants. When you have a God this powerful as Job has just seen, what do you let him do in your life? A God this powerful and this wise? And the answer is anything he wants. And you don't do that out of dread. There is a glad surrender to letting him do all that he wants because he has that kind of power and that kind of wisdom and that kind of love. It is in my best interest, too, to let him do what he wants. Because the happiness of the creature depends on that submission. "I know that thou canst do anything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee. Who is this that hideth counsel without knowledge? Who's spoken before he knew anything?" Job says, "Therefore have I uttered that I understood not. Things too wonderful for me that I knew not." Now, the negligence or the ignorance of this grand reality is what is getting Joel and Phil into trouble. And I call the application of that grand reality the grand reality principle. Above the line is the sovereign. And when we're thinking of this universally, God is that ultimate sovereign. But he exercises his biblical sovereignty, with greatness and goodness. God rules by virtue of his greatness. And when I use the term greatness, I'm talking about those attributes of his infinite power and his infinite wisdom and his infinite unchangeableness, his infinite presence. Those are his powers. And those are the powers that give him the right and the might to rule. But that greatness is never exercised without his goodness. It would be a scary planet to live on if he ever exercised his greatness without his goodness. And by his goodness, I mean those attributes of his mercy and his compassion, his infinite love and his infinite grace to us. Now, when a man in the home or anybody else in a leadership position is given a position of sovereignty, of headship, of rulership, of leadership, they have a position of greatness, of power. That power may become, because as a dad, I am physically stronger than my wife. My voice has a lot more strength to it than my wife's does. When the children were younger, my "no ma'am" could bring a whole lot more startle into their existence than my wife's "no ma'am" to them. Just because, by virtue of being a man with a different set of vocal cords and lungs, and there's a greater power in the voice, an authority that comes along with his headship. And all of that gives a greater sense of greatness or power to him in this leadership role. But he must exercise that greatness with goodness if he's going to rule in the fear of God. And if he does, he will be welcomed like a cloudless morning, David says. Now, Joel and Phil have powers of greatness. Both of them are in headship in their home and by virtue legal powers of the state and a biblical role and authority there, they have the authority in the home. They are the biblical sovereigns in that home. And they have a certain amount of greatness. What both of them lack is goodness. And it's very, very easy when you have power to misuse it. I grew up in a family of motorcyclists, and I got my first motorcycle of a sorts. It was a Fox mini bike when I was 14 years old. It had go-kart wheels and a Tecumseh 2.5 horsepower lawnmower engine on it with a centrifugal clutch. And going downhill with the wind at my back, I could do about 30 miles an hour. And I thought that was moving. It was compared to my bicycle. And Dad already had a bike or two, and it was real exciting. And I got back in South Dakota in those days, you could get a motorcycle permit when you were 14. So I licensed that little thing, put a light on it, and I drove it. I'd drive about 3.5 miles into town for ninth grade. I went to country school through eighth grade, but I had to drive into town for ninth grade. So I drove that in two-lane country highway in ninth grade, and it puttered and sputtered and got there. But it was a neat thing, it had that show thing to it too, because I was the only ninth grader that was driving anything in our little school. But then I saved up my money and I bought a Honda 50 Sport. And I tell you what, that was power. And you know what? For a little while, I was dangerous. I mean, I was really cautious. Excuse me. I was cautious for a little while. And then when I got used to the power, I got dangerous. And then my next bike, I drove that for a year or so, and then my next bike was a Honda 305 Scrambler, which was kind of the cat's meow back in the mid-60s. And that bike had a lot of guts to it. And I drove that very cautiously, too, until I got used to the power, and then I became dangerous to me and other people. Fortunately, I was the only one who I ever hurt with that. But the point I'm trying to make is that anytime we are given positions of power, we are often very cautious with it at the first until we get used to it. You know, I forget sometimes what power Dean of Students has from a student's perspective. But, you know, somebody comes into my office and this little girl sits down in the chair in front of my desk to ask about something or other, and her neck just breaks out in red blotches, you know, and she's nervous. And I'm reminded, you know, I think, I don't know why she's nervous. I'm real comfortable in here. This is, you know, I'm reminded that, you know, to her there's this enormous power differential, you know. But it's easy for me to get used to it, and that's a caution to all of us who have power, because it is easy to get used to it. And you have this greatness, and if you don't maintain the goodness, you can hurt people with your power. And if you are exercising your sovereignty right, those under you will be experiencing both humility under your sovereignty and hope. See, your greatness before somebody that you're having to rule ought to engender a certain kind of humility in them. But the goodness that they sense in you ought to also give them hope when they're around you. And that is missing in Joel and Phil. And their greatness is only bringing a very wooden humility in the people under them, and the exercise of their sovereignty is not bringing any hope at all, because there's no humility in those men. When a man has rightly seen God, if we look at this now, instead of the husband being the sovereign and the wife being the subordinate and the children being the subordinate here, if we take this father, this husband, and put him in the position of biblical sovereignty, and God is his sovereign, and that's reality. If that man is truly seeing the greatness of God and the goodness of God, what is that mix going to produce in his life? The fear of the Lord. And what effect is that going to have on him? It's going to humble him as well as giving him great hope, because the Lord is here. That humbles me, but it also gives me great hope when I carry out what He wants me to do. He's here to help. And so no man can say, well, I was never raised that way, or I don't know what to do on that, and I'm just always discouraged about it. You haven't been in front of God much then. Because He brings hope to you that He's present here with you. And He can be, when He has been before God, He has been very humbled by God, but then God gives Him mandates and commands of what to do, and even though He feels very weak in Himself, He has great courage and great boldness, because God is here and is with him, and that is his hope. Now, there is a little symbol over at the right-hand portion of that line, and that TM does not stand for transcendental meditation. You all know what it means. It means a trademark. And the reason I put that over there is because every relationship on earth ought to bear this imprint, this trademark. That if you are in a position, wherever you are in a position of sovereignty, you ought to be exercising your greatness with goodness. And whatever position of subordination you're in, you ought to be exercising your humility with hope. So, well, as a wife or as a child, I don't have a lot of hope because my dad is exercising all his greatness without any goodness. Yes, but you have another sovereign, and that is the God of heaven. We're going to talk about that tomorrow morning. How do you operate before somebody, when you have a sovereign who's not either great or good? Well, then you constantly place yourself, as you must every day anyway, before the God of heaven who is great and good, and that gives you the proper humility before that authority with the proper hope under that authority. And we're going to look at that tomorrow. And gentlemen, if you and I are spending the time with God and letting God show himself to us in all of his greatness and his goodness, we will be ruling in the fear of God, and people will welcome our leadership like a cloudless morning is welcomed. From that, we come to some rules, God's rules for rulers. And the first one is, no one who has been granted authority is free to use that authority in ways not authorized by God himself. No one who has been granted authority is free to use that authority in ways not authorized by God himself. There is a strict accountability to God for the way we rulers use our sovereignty. Let me show you several passages about that. Ephesians 6:9, "And ye masters, do the same things unto them." Now, Paul has just talked to servants. "Forbearing threatening, knowing that your master also is in heaven." Now, what is Paul doing here? He's saying, now you slave owners, you Christian slave owners in this assembly in Ephesus, don't use threatening against your slaves. And don't be heavy-handed with them, because I want to remind you, you have a master too. What is he doing? He's trying to put the fear of God in a sovereign, so that he won't misuse his greatness. He says, knowing that your master, and by the way, you and I can read master, and we kind of have this New Testament Christianized flavor of what master is. When somebody in a first century church heard the word master, they knew what that meant. That meant somebody else owns you and has a right to tell you anything he wants to tell you. And so here's this New Testament master, slave owner, sitting there hearing Paul say, you have someone who owns you and has a right to tell you what to do too, and don't forget that. And neither is there respect of persons with him. People may bow and scrape to you down here, but that doesn't pull any stuff with God. Colossians 4:1, "Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." What is it? He's bringing the same thing to bear. James 3:1, "My brethren, be not many masters," or don't be ambitious to be teachers. knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation because we're going to appear before our master one day. You'll have the stricter judgment. James, or 1 Peter 5, 1-14. This is an abbreviated portion of those verses. Peter is writing and he says, "The elders which are among you I exhort." He's talking about the spiritual leaders. "Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by compulsion, but willingly, not out of greed for gain." I've substituted some words there that are a little more easy to understand. "But eagerly take that responsibility." And then notice this, "neither as lording it over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock, because the chief shepherd is going to appear. And when he shall appear, you shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away." What is he reminding them of? He says, you've been given a responsibility to be a shepherd, but don't forget, there's a chief shepherd who is going to appear. Now, men, you and I must take these admonitions to heart. And ladies, too, when God puts you in any kind of mastership over somebody. We all have a master in heaven that we're accountable to. Let's say that, let me illustrate this with the way a police officer can use his power. He's issued a badge and a gun, other things as well. But those are symbols. The badge is a symbol of a reminder, not just a symbol, it's a statement of his right. You know, if somebody comes to your door and flashes a badge and says, "I'm from the FBI, we need to talk." What does that badge say to you? That he has a right to ask me a bunch of questions, right? The badge is that statement of his right. His gun is a statement of might. Unless you are faster than a speeding bullet, that gun gives him an enormous advantage of might. Okay? Now, he can only use that badge and gun only, however, in ways that he's been authorized by his authority to use it. If a police officer is running a little bit short on cash and finds a guy who's over the speed limit or has a cracked taillight or something and decides to pull him over, and he tells the guy to get out of the car and put his hands on the top of the car, and he frisks him, and the guy is arguing with him, "What is this all about?" And he takes out his gun, sticks in his ribs, and says, "Shut up." You know, and maybe the guy, says, "No, listen, all I'm, he throws him down on the ground, kicks him in the ribs, puts him in handcuffs, takes his wallet, puts him back in, uncuffs him, and says, "Don't ever drive over the speed limit again." Now, that is an abuse of power. We would call that police brutality. Now, he has power. He has greatness. But this man doesn't have goodness, nor does he have any awareness that he has a master over him who's going to hold him accountable for what he just did. It's a sad thing to say, but there are a lot of husbands that act just like that with their right and their might. On the other hand, let's say that there's a police officer who is on his evening drive in his area of patrol, and a dispatch comes over for any vehicles in the area that there's a robbery, an armed robbery going on at such and such a place, and it's within a few blocks of him, but he's been listening to the ball game, and it's in the ninth inning, and it's pretty tight, and he doesn't want to interrupt that, and so he just sits in a parking lot, listens to the rest of the game, then goes check on it, and finds out that somebody was shot and killed and all of that. Now, here is a man who had the power, he had the might and the right, but failed to use it. Both of these men are acting very selfishly with their power. One abuses it selfishly, and the other one fails to use it selfishly. And both of them are destructive. And both men are, and neither man is walking in the fear of God. We cannot abuse it, and we cannot fail to use it. When God has put us in a position of leadership, He's given us might and right, and we must use it, but not abuse it. I like to think of the role in the home that the husband is the greenhouse keeper. Because the home is a greenhouse for growing spiritual plants. Say, Berg, you got farming on the brain. Where do you get that? Well, I'll tell you where I get that. Ephesians 5, 25 to 29. You're familiar with this passage, just listen to it. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. This is a directive to a husband about his wife. That he might, what's he going to do? Why has he been given this position? That he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of the water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing. The job in this marriage is to improve the spouse, as Christ improves the church. But that it should be holy and without blemish, so ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but look at this, but nourisheth and cherisheth it. Those are terms of growing. Even as the Lord does this for the church. Gentlemen, why did God give you a wife? So you could spiritually grow her up to be like Jesus Christ. That is the major reason he gave you a wife. Look at the directives that are given to fathers. And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up, and hear the words again, in the nurture and admonition, the growth in the Lord. Now that's why I say God has given us as men the responsibility to be chief greenhouse keepers. That means that it's our job to regulate the atmosphere within the greenhouse so that the plants can grow. That means there are a lot of things we don't let in, a lot of pests and animals that we don't let come into the greenhouse, that we don't let cold, winter winds come into the greenhouse. We don't let the sun come into the greenhouse without some shading on certain days and some ventilation so that it doesn't get too hot in there. And we're the ones who go around and find out where the disease is, and we prune and we treat the disease and we water and we fertilize. That's our job, to grow spiritual plants. That's the only reason God has given us power in that home. And a husband and a father can use his headship to accomplish only God's purposes for his wife and children. It's only one reason we've been given a badge and a gun: to grow plants, not to force them to shine our shoes and fetch our iced tea and do our dirty work. That's not why we were given a badge and a gun. In those areas, we ought to be the best servants of the house. We ought to be the one getting the iced tea for the rest of them as examples, like our Lord did, of ministering to other people. And we use our badge and our gun to control the atmosphere and to help nourish the plants and feed the plants and all of that. And there will be times when a father has to put his foot down about worldly elements that are penetrating the greenhouse. And he's going to have to address diseases, attitudes that he sees in his children, and attitudes that he might see in his wife. And by the way, gentlemen, we don't treat our wife as one of the kids. They're not one of the, she is one body with us. And we deal with her as tenderly and gingerly as we deal with ourselves. You know, when you're taking a splinter out of somebody else's toe, it's easy to be aggressive. When it's your own toe, we are really, really tender about that. And gentlemen, when you and I have to address our wife about something, we need to be as tender with them as we are with ourselves. She's not one of the children. She's one flesh with us, one person with us. You may have to insist that the children take music lessons unto a certain age. That's putting a stake down beside the plant and tying it up as it goes, so that and providing some structure so that it can mature right. Putting the tomato plant inside a cage. Say, you're going to stay inside that cage until you get this baby. Providing the structure, that's part of what we have to do. A dad may have to insist that a child not take a job that takes him out of church or keeps him from teen mission trips. And husbands and fathers need to be very aware of those things. He has to know his plants well and know how to effectively treat their problems. And he has to do with such with a goodness that breeds hope and humility in them. Any use of his power for his own ends or in the wrong spirit is an abuse of power. His home is not a man's home is not a man's palace. It is not a man's crash pad. It is not a man's entertainment center. It is not a man's hunting lodge. It is not a man's business center. It is a place for him to grow spiritual plants. Now, let's talk about two types of fleshly headship, and I must hurry on here. The first one is a self-serving authoritarianism. This is a heavy-handed, mean-fisted, I rule my way or the highway kind of thing. If you don't like it around here, then, you know, pack your dirty duds and get out of here. Now, there may be a time when we need to say something like that, but it needs to be said in a... That isn't the way the prodigal son let his son go. The prodigal son's father let him go. This is a man who pleases himself by controlling others more than God intends. He controls them too strictly. And he pleases himself by ruling others in a spirit God forbids too harshly. I call that the spirit of Saul. And I have a concern about a rising number of fathers in Christian circles that I see, particularly as they interact with secretaries and the dean of women's office at school. Some heavy-handed men who don't think twice about tearing up a woman, but when I get on the phone, they're as sweet as can be. That's self-serving authoritarianism. It's a spirit of Saul, and I don't have time to say more about it. There's also a self-serving permissivism. This is a man who pleases himself by allowing more than God intends. He's operating too tolerantly. That is the spirit of Eli, who wouldn't rebuke his two sons. And God removed his leadership from him because of that. This is a husband who can neglect his responsibilities in the parenting, in the finances. He just wants to be left alone. He's not using his greatness, his might, and his right to control the climate of the home. He's passive, and that's just as lethal as being controlling and heavy-handed. And you know, he may feel very, very uneasy and lack confidence in that. All he needs to do is get before God. And God's power and God's goodness will give him a lot of hope. There's hope for us men, whatever, you know, and you know, we can be real flexible in this. You know, one day we can be a real tyrant, and the next day we can be a real couch potato. We're real flexible in the way we demonstrate our fleshliness. And you know what the solution is for all of us? A constant study of who our God is and a constant exposure to who He is that creates the fear of God in us, that gives us humility and hope. Mind you again of the last words of David. Well, let me give you this statement before that. Leadership isn't about controlling others as much as it is about controlling our own lusts, our own pride. Remind you about the last words of David again. He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of God. And he will be welcomed like a fresh, cloudless morning. Lord Jesus, we as men and as women in leadership need your help in these matters. It's so easy for us to walk in the flesh. And the people under us are crushed. And they are stripped of hope because we don't use the right and the might you have given us in a proper fashion. And Lord Jesus, this is so much of a problem for every one of us. It is so easy for us to want to do things our own way. And Lord Jesus, we need your help. we need you to open our eyes about your greatness and your goodness so that we can be properly humbled and given hope. And I pray that you would give us, as a church, as individuals, a greater awareness of who you are so that we can represent you better before others and we can walk in your fear. Help us to that end, we pray. In your name, amen.